Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Alfred Lemon of the Historic New Orleans Collection about the new exhibit, Spanish New Orleans in the Caribbean, and its accompanying catalog. We'll also hear from poet Ann Babson, whose new collection, her fourth, is The Bunker Book. Alfred Lemon is the director of one of our city's great treasures, the Williams Research Center of the Historic New Orleans Collection. He's here to talk about the exhibit, Spanish New Orleans and the Caribbean, on view until January 22nd, and the beautiful accompanying catalog. This bilingual book includes essays by scholars Light, Townsend Cummings, and Richard Campanella, as well as gorgeous illustrations and in-depth looks at some of the 120 books, documents, paintings, and objects in the exhibit. Alfred is an authority on French and Spanish colonial history, so this exhibit is a particular labor of love. Alfred Lemon, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure being here today.
What a beautiful book this is.
It is. It's a tribute to the publication staff, because, you know, people that write books are not always the best people to make them visually interesting.
It takes a village. It really does.
Plus, they know how to edit.
Well, you have to write. That's your part of this.
As Ray Barone of Everybody Loves Raymond once said, it's all about editing.
Now, there's this wonderful essay in this book, Richard Campanella's essay, Urbanism Comes to Nueva Orleans. And he sums up the Spanish era in one brief sentence. Began secretly in 1762, publicly in 1764, politically in 1766, militarily in 1769, and ended with comparable ambiguity following an 1800 to 1803 interregnum that saw three flags fly in as many years. Whew, that is a lot.
I know it.
I mean,
our history is just so exciting. But you have to go back and think about one thing.
What's that?
You know, the Spaniards were here first, Hernando de Soto, and they didn't find any gold or silver, so they just focused on Peru and Mexico.
Right.
Then, eventually, France claimed Louisiana, but if you notice, they didn't rush to colonize it.
Mm-hmm.
Or to develop it. It wasn't until the Treaty of Ryswick in 1798 where they began to think about colonizing it.
So we had land and no people.
Well, we had the Native Americans.
Right, of course.
And then something happened. And that's the key to everything.
So?
The King of Spain died. He was the last Habsburg king. He had no heir. However, his sister was married to Louis XIV. So Spain passed to France. And it was really rather interesting, because the first person in line that would become Louis XV,
mm-hmm.
he could not become King of Spain because he was next in line to become King of France. They needed a spare, so the second person in line could not become King of Spain. But the third person, the Duc d'Anjou, became King of Spain. And this, of course, was emotionally traumatic for the British, the Austro-Hungarians, because with Spain and France both being under the Bourbon rule, it was going to upset the balance of power.
Right.
So there ensued a rather lengthy War of the Spanish Succession. And France began slowly beginning to make efforts to colonize what was then known as La Louisiane.
Right.
During that very lengthy war. But something strange happens. Bienville becomes governor. But could you imagine in the 18th century trying to go up to Quebec or Montreal to get supplies that is always frozen?
Oh, no.
Could you imagine going to Saint-Domingue, where you had to be traveling through the Caribbean, that was the home to the pirates of the Caribbean?
Mm-hmm.
No. So who did the French rely upon for a great deal? The Spaniards, Havana and Veracruz. They relied on both cities for everything from animals, food, small boats, military equipment, so much so that Bienville actually sent a delegation to Mexico City to thank the Viceroy of New Spain, as Mexico was then called, to thank him personally for the efforts extended toward the new colony. Now, that's not to say that they always got along perfectly in the Gulf of Mexico. They had their territorial differences. But throughout the entire French period of New Orleans, the Spanish, the most Catholic monarch, and the French, his most Christian monarch, they were constantly signing family pacts, drawing them closer and closer and closer together. In fact, where do you think Louis XIV's collection of beautiful crystal is?
Uh-oh. Where? Is this a trick question?
In the Prado Museum. So you can see just how close the two were.
So I want you to talk a little bit about how you curate an exhibit like this. As I told you before, I was so fascinated by this tusk of a mastodon.
Oh.
That made it into the exhibit.
That is a story.
Well, tell it.
Well, you know, this was the period of the Enlightenment.
Right. Lucky for us that coincided.
Exactly. And I'll give you an unfair question. The Prado Museum, what was it originally built as?
I have no idea.
It was built as the Natural History Museum.
Ah.
Or the Cabinet of Curiosities for Carlos III. That whole part of Madrid is a tremendous tribute to science and the Enlightenment. And so people were collecting this material. And the Archbishop of Mexico was a very avid collector. And he sent an expedition to Louisiana to find prehistoric materials.
Just prehistoric materials?
That's what he was interested in from here. And then he's promoted. He becomes Cardinal of Toledo.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Primate of Spain.
Right.
Which is a very big post. And he continues collecting. Finally, he dies. At the time of his death, his library consisted of 400 incunabulae,
mm-hmm.
that's books published at the very beginning of printing,
books. Yeah.
Which is quite exciting. 100,000 books, paintings and portraits,
mm-hmm.
and his cabinet of curiosities from around the world. I'll let you in on a secret. When you visit the exhibit and you see this tusk that could be as old as 25 million years, you see not only the tusk, but the original handwritten card mm-hmm. used to identify it.
Wow.
And there's just so much. You know, in Louisiana, we're so spoiled to having such a rich
mm-hmm.
history.
We've been talking with Alfred Lemon, who's the director of one of our city's great treasures, the Williams Research Center. And he's been talking about the exhibit and the accompanying catalog, Spanish New Orleans and the Caribbean, on view until January 22nd. Don't miss it. Alfred, thank you so much. It's been such a treat.
Well, thank you for having me.
It is such a pleasure to welcome poet Ann Babson back to The Reading Life. Ann teaches writing and literature at Southeastern Louisiana University, and she is the president of the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans. She is the author of several collections of poetry and chapbooks as well, and her work appeared in that great anthology, Nasty Women Poets, an unapologetic anthology of subversive verse. Her new collection, their fourth, The Bunker Book, is a look at one woman's pandemic experience, but so much more. Much of it may take place in a bunker, but it is a thrilling example of a mind and spirit at play. Ann Babson, welcome.
It is so good to be back with you, Susan. It is so nice to see you. Hello.
Hello. So talk about the bunker and how this concept evolved for you. And just the idea developing over time, it is so perfect for the times we've been living in.
Sadly, yes, we've been going through some rough times. Everybody's half crazy in the world, I think, right now. Basically, I studied medieval literature at Ole Miss, and one of the things that intrigued me was a genre of work that I had no reason to resurrect until very recently, which was called the plague tale, because people who had no control over their health and no understanding even of what a germ or a virus was, in order not to go crazy from seclusion, would write tales to entertain themselves. And I also found that in the era of division that we live in right now, where there are many people who are talking about censorship, that I found myself increasingly drawn to the writers of the French Resistance, who had had to defy an authoritarian regime. And both of these spirits seemed to be converging on the American landscape, and I set it in New Orleans. Basically, most poetry books don't have a narrative element, but this has a frame around a lot of other discussions that is a narrative in which a woman, at a time when they are burning books in the library in New Orleans, decides she will create for herself an underground bunker in what she says is an abandoned missile silo near New Orleans. I'm hoping that's fiction. And she camps out basically almost like in a bomb shelter with the books that she has saved. However, they seem to be mostly books that you would find in the British National Library, a lot of medieval books. And because she is in this bunker for long enough that it's really quite some time, the books talk back to her. I mean, we all want the voices of authors to talk back to her, but she's in the middle of another medieval form, which is called a dialogue, a dialogio, if you use the Italian, where the great ideas that have been walked around are throughout the times are being discussed. And I suppose that in terms of its application to this day, this frame for an otherwise more typical collection of poetry is that New Orleans is a palimpsest. The past is under the more modern, which is under the yet more modern, which is under our street today. And what I found was that if I wanted to understand how we might survive and even thrive in a time such as ours, that the past might have something important to say to us.
Well, read the June Bunker poem, because this sort of sets the scene and talks about some of the companionship the narrator chooses to surround herself with.
Okay. This is part of that narrative frame I was talking about. June Bunker. People save top tiers of wedding cakes in freezers. Miss Havisham petrifies hers. Jane Austen leads her readers to the altar, then strands them all there. Rick's last free train leaves without his Ilsa. So-called friends, save Lisa, knew he cheated. They didn't say boo. When I demanded of them, come on, we have to resist these. They are burning books in the schoolyards. And he made sardonic remarks about a functionally illiterate America. They knew he would never join me in my curfew-breaking sorties. They knew when I said words mean something, he wouldn't even drive U-Hauls to the grain elevator that descended the abandoned missile silo. They knew he wouldn't unload boxes I labeled biohazard, filled with libraries and supplies. They knew. Only my rescue pit bull called Shotgun. Miss Havisham sits in the drawing room, clock stopped by her author, stuck in her bitterness. Not I. I just waited out. He never asked that last night where I was going. He knew. There is a timer on the pressure lock. I have enough to survive the decade if I need to. My dog and I hope for parole. The books down here could last an epoch. I will take myself out of the freezer and share myself once more. I am coming soon with Alpha through Omega, Beowulf through Angela's ashes. I will share these living words, the priest bearing a Eucharist to be taken by the faithful, or at least by those who repent.
Beowulf through Angela's ashes.
Beowulf was an obvious choice. I thought about what's a good what would I personally reach for if I had only a limited time to get books out of a library where they were going to burn them. And Frank McCourt, who I had the great pleasure as a teenager to meet and learn a little bit from, is an icon for me. So it was easy for me to imagine ripping his books off that shelf and going in underground with them if need be.
Well, it's easy for me to imagine the bunker, the dog, the bookshelves, everything. I can move right in. Well, one of the wonderful things about this book is that it has this kind of spiritual rhythm as you read it, you know, the descent, the dialogues, the emergence at the end. It's really, you're on the journey. You feel the rhythm of the journey as you're taking it, and you leave on such a bright, exuberant note. That's what I love about this. So I turned the last page and I went, oh, so.
Well, I am so glad that you found it that way. I am hopeful, despite all the nonsense that the world has presented to all of us these days. I am hopeful. I do believe perhaps naively, that human goodness is persistent and can be counted upon when evil wears itself out to take back territory.
Oh, I hope so.
That's
we're talking in the new year, too, so it's good to have this book to start the year.
It's a good day to just get to the place where you say to yourself, maybe things weren't as good as I would have wished last year or the year before, but maybe things could actually get better. Who knows?
I devoutly hope so.
Let us pray.
So, all right, well, let us hear the last poem,
all
which
right.
is so wonderful.
This is the last part of the framed narrative. It is called When the Saints Go Marching. First, at midnight, as Lisa and I covenanted, a tennis ball plunged through a bent pipe, clanging into a bucket. That was the Paul Revere lantern for me. At 9, a crash, a flurry of pounding on the trapdoor above. I knew. My hand got scraped by the giant wheel. I turned in a fury. For the first time in an eon, I felt wind touch my hair. It was so bright. I felt motion sickness. Lisa hugged me in a blanket like a spent marathoner at the finish line. But she was the one who looked exhausted. Where were my words? They were stashed in bookshelves still underground. I could not speak. Lisa handed me a glass as I bent limp and fetal, now barefoot on the hot sidewalk. I heard bubbles as she poured. Where are your shoes? She asked me. The dog remained below, still unsure it was safe to travel out. I blinked in the big blue air and called him to fetch my flip-flops. He obeyed, his paws touching soil he could claw for the first time since we moved underground and hid the libraries. We won, is all Lisa shouted, and I understood. We won, she repeated. And then the rest of them arrived in stripes, a brass band with magician assistants from a show where the lady gets sawed in half and put back together again. We won, I parroted in a whisper. We won, I repeated, white as a sheet. The musicians started, not knowing if this were a jazz funeral or just a second line. We danced. Lisa had brought a parasol. I staggered, then found the beat. The dog circled us, barking. We marched down the avenue past buildings on fire, old men with long beards and torn clothes, past antique shops with broken panes but nothing stolen. We marched past empty groceries and the occasional cadaver. We danced toward City Hall on Perdido Street. That word means lost in Creole. And we were tipsy by then, staggering onto the steps. I saw the flags I did not recognize, but I recognized the song. It is ours. Oh, how I long to be in that number. We won. We won. We The Saints Went Marching.
Now, if anybody were here, they would now believe in film rights for poetry.
That was wonderful. Please contact me at my website. I am willing to negotiate with you, whether you be Steven Spielberg or the Hallmark Channel. Please contact me.
That is a parade we should all want to join and be part of.
Isn't that true?
It is. It totally is. We've been talking with poet Ann Babson, whose new collection is The Bunker Book. You can meet her at her book launch party Tuesday, January 10th at 6:30 at L'Union Francaise. That's at 4522 Britannia Street. Ann, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure to see you, Susan.
What's on tap in the literary life? If your New Year's resolution is to read more this year, you might want to begin with One Book, One New Orleans 2023 selection, the short story collection, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You. It's by Maurice Carlos Ruffin. You have all year to read it, so get started. The monthly Writers' Clinic takes place Saturday, January 7th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The sessions for beginners or experienced writers are free and open to the public, no registration. At 9:30, Bill Lofelm discusses cultivating suspense in your work, followed by Rolf Van Anders at 11, who will present yoga and the power of creativity. Blue Cypress Books hosts a reading with local poet Nikki Ummel, joined by Lauren Weathers and Elizabeth Mickey Brina, Monday, January 9th at 6. Wayne Flint discusses and signs his book, Afternoons with Harper Lee, Tuesday, January 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Anne Babson reads from and signs The Bunker Book, Tuesday, January 10th at 6:30 at L'Alliance Française, 4522 Britannia Street. The Jefferson Parish Library is partnering with the Southern Food and Beverage Museum to conduct food demonstrations once a month at both regional facilities. The food demonstration at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie takes place Wednesday, January 11th at 7. The one at the West Bank Regional Library occurs at 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 18th. Liz Williams, president and founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and author of Nana's Creole Italian Table, will teach participants how to make a Creole favorite, pasta sauce with squash. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.